You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of November 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
As Donald Trump is named president-elect of the United States, we'll be hearing both the noble and the honest opinions of the Americans he'll preside over.
It's just heartbreaking. He's racist. He disrespects women. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
My guests, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards, will be discussing these and also gauging the international reception to Trump's win.
I may respectfully say to some of my beloved European friends and colleagues that I think it's time we snapped out of the general doom and gloom about the result of this election and the collective whingerama that seems to be going on in some places.
All that, plus we'll ask how the business magnet will do in the biggest job on the planet, with almost no practical experience of politics at all. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, my guests today are Monocle's executive and foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and also executive producer of Monocle 24, Tom Edwards. That's more executives than on a Trump board table, I think. But anyway, welcome both to the programme. One story has dominated the headlines this week. Billionaire political outsider Donald Trump secured the win for the US presidency and will take office succeeding Barack Obama early next year. We'll be talking about the impact even of the US election over the next 30 minutes. But first, let's remind ourselves of the biggest story of the week as told by Monocle 24 and media around the globe.
Donald Trump is on the verge of becoming the next president of the United States of America. A tumultuous night, one that began with Hillary Clinton confident of victory, slowly changed course.
Donald Trump wins the presidency. The business tycoon and TV personality capping his improbable political journey with an astounding upset victory.
Utterly shocked. No one saw this coming, perhaps, other than Trump. This is the biggest political upset in U.S. history, probably in world history.
Oh my God. I woke up and I saw the results on my phone, and it's just heartbreaking. He's racist. He's just, you know, he disrespects women. I mean, it's heartbreaking. I just hope some of the right things that he said, he goes by his word, you know? That's all I hope for.
At the end of the day, we're all humans, and I think if we give him a chance, he'll do something good. Let's see what happens.
Donald Trump supporters who felt kind of chastised in New York City, they didn't really feel that they could be open about voting for Trump, feel kind of vindicated.
Phenomenal. I've had 8 years of hard work since the communist Obama took power. And what you're seeing tonight is the reaction against Obama is pretty much what's going on.
Now, I can't help but notice you are a fellow Brit. Even a lot of conservatives in the UK don't like Donald Trump. What makes him different for you?
Well, a lot of conservatives in the US don't like Donald Trump.
Michigan went to Trump. Ohio went to Trump. Pennsylvania, where I was last month, went to Trump. And the areas, people say, oh my God, these rural areas, they're all coming out in droves to vote for Trump. They are as deprived and starved of investment as the inner cities were in the 60s and 70s.
The Trump victory fills my heart and my mind with fear of what the next era is going to be like. And at the same time, some hope that at least we are done with those toxic illusions in trickle-down economics.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
Well, among the voices you heard there were commentators such as Michael Goldfarb, the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, former Mitt Romney spokesman, Ryan Williams, Monocle's bureau chief, Ed Stocker, and the great American public. Steve, what happened this week?
Well, what happened this week was a race-baiting, Muslim-hating misogynist who had bragged about sexually assaulting women was elected the 45th president of the United States. That we know for sure. Why, how, what it means, that's going to take a little bit longer to get into. But I think if you look at who voted and how and where, in a sense, this isn't as seismic as I think some people have tried to say over the last 2 days. This is Hillary Clinton is going to win, once all the votes are counted, probably 61 million votes, a good million or so more than Donald Trump. In fact, only I think George W. Bush would have, of the Republicans in the of the past 30 years, would have won more votes than that. Six out of the last seven US presidential elections have been won in terms of popular vote by the Democrats. So this idea that this is a mass rejection of the center-left or a mass rejection of Obama isn't quite true. Mitt Romney, in fact, has won more votes 4 years ago than Donald Trump did this time. Having said all that, the fact of who he is and the campaign that he ran as an autocrat and made no bones about that, is astonishing and shocking.
I read a piece yesterday, Tom, which was saying that if you look at the numbers, there was a piece of comfort in one of the American papers saying, if you're looking for comfort, these are the things you need to know, that you know the majority of Americans, despite this, the majority of Americans believe in gay marriage. Most people are not actually racist. The majority of people would not turn against a Muslim neighbour. But what they voted on was something which is, you know, we're still working out, but was certainly more rooted in economy, a sense that whether right or wrong, they believe that Donald Trump can take them back to a day of glorious industrial wealth again. Are you shaken in your... You know, it's the same here in Europe after we had the Brexit vote. Are you shaken in your perception of who Americans are? Or do you think, like Steve, think actually it's only a little tip that's brought Mr. Trump to power?
Well, I think it's interesting that you make that comparison with Brexit, because we had similar conversations. And I guess maybe it was personally more shocking in the aftermath of the Brexit vote than this as a Brit because of what I thought had happened. But the similarities are quite stark. I think we've seen a group of people, a large group, a new demographic, if you like, who, exactly as you've said, Andrew, from that piece, are voting not necessarily for Trump and against Hillary or against liberal values or for Republican values. And Trump himself, you know, he even used to be a Democrat. I think they're voting about opportunity or the lack of it. They're voting about a feeling that they've been left behind. And if you come back to that Brexit vote, it was very similar. I don't believe that all the people who voted to leave Europe were even intensely, intensely sort of anti-European. I think they were anti-establishment. And what we're seeing now and what we can anticipate seeing in other votes, even in safe Western liberal democracies like in France or in the Netherlands or in Germany, is a further statement of people's dissatisfaction with two things, with the political processes and also with the political classes. And I think that's why Hillary Clinton, as Steve said, despite the numbers suggesting she sort of did okay in part, she failed to galvanize certain demographics she needed to win that election, because she was perceived as being too much a part of an establishment that too many people felt didn't represent them and had failed them.
But what a failing. That in this election, when you are up against a billionaire who doesn't pay taxes, who is going to cut taxes for the rich, and he manages to paint Hillary Clinton as the friend of Wall Street.
But the thing was, Steve, I don't even think this was the picture that Trump necessarily painted. And you politely described what he's just performed as a campaign. It was hardly even that. It was free from policy. It was free, really, from any overriding ideology that I could identify. He simply said, I'm different, I'm new. And people, exactly, they overlooked everything. And I really wonder whether anybody was going to be able to withstand that narrative from him, that he was the change candidate.
I just want to go back to the thing you raised about the people who are left behind, because we've heard that quite a lot. And there is an extent I agree, to which that is true. But let's look at the numbers of people who...
It's a perception, Steve. I would say that very clearly. It's a perception of
the people
behind.
Who earn under $50,000, the majority of them, by 51% to 42%, voted for Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump won the people who earn between $50,000 and $100,000. That's the middle class.
And to be fair to both candidates, they were after that middle class vote. They both were trying to say that they recognise that there was something wrong with the middle class, and they were going to step in and help them. And it's the middle classes who feel that they're being taxed too much, whereas poor people are often out of the tax threshold. It's those people that were very sensitive to the vote. But it makes you think some big questions, on women's rights, for example. We take it for granted that the world has changed and that politics has changed and business has changed, and that you would never ever speak about women like that, and you would never get away with it, and that if you did speak like that, women would turn against you. We see it in companies every day across the world, and especially in the United States. I mean, it's a shame we don't have a woman to chip in now, but what do you think, Steve, it says about women voters that in the end it didn't matter that much that he was, he got 40% of the women who voted for him. He did not deter women from voting for him.
I think he might have deterred some women from voting
I'm
for
sure,
him.
I'm sure.
But you're right. I think, look, the thing is, when people vote, they take into account lots of different things, and some will be economic policy, some will just be culture, some will be emotion, the way that you feel about someone when you go to where you go to vote. And I think, it's... I don't know. The whole thing is complicated, and I'm losing my train of thought at the end of a long week.
Tom, just let me ask you a question about the TV side of it before we move on. One of the funny things is, it's a broader question. We all see so much reality TV, we all are surrounded by it. And there's a sense within whatever the program is, whether it's, a Pop Idol program or an X Factor program, or whether it's, something like The Apprentice, that you can be a nobody who within 12 weeks can be the biggest pop star in the world. We have this acceptance of this rapid transition from non-entity to success. And I wonder if not that people are idiots, far from it, but they have got used to this idea that you don't really need any training, skill, background, history, you can make it in no time. And they see Mr. Trump as the personification of the world that they're surrounded by, where they buy into entertainment every day. And he is part of that story.
Well, absolutely. And again, it taps into this idea about perceptions. And that's why Steve was right to take me to task for what I said about people being left behind, because it's only a perception of that. And if you have a perception that anybody can do anything and having qualifications or skills or expertise counts for nothing, this is an absolute validation of that, because Trump has no experience. He has ostensibly no transferable skills for this, because he's this sort of reality monster. I think what's also interesting, and this is a challenge for politicians as we go forwards, wherever we are in the world, is that they seem to be held weirdly to a different set of standards. So Donald Trump can be, explicitly misogynistic, racist, xenophobic, bullying, and it counts nothing for him. If anything, his ratings ticked along or bubbled up when the most sort of egregious examples happened. Hillary Clinton, however, never really managed to shake off this notion, which he helped to propagate, that she was untrustworthy or unlikable or cold or detached. And it seemed that the American public maybe felt that those were criticisms of a politician that were legitimate, whereas for a reality star, they're used to absolutes. People are heroes or villains. They can be both at once, Andrew, as you just suggested. So I wonder whether the political classes need to adapt or make explicit the fact that they are just people too, and that they have the same foibles as someone like
Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson today. That, you know, they have a perception, whether rightfully or wrongly, that, you know, they're the kind of people that you'd spend an evening in the pub getting lashed up with, and, you know, would be quite entertaining.
But look at Boris, he's a good example. He's now the Foreign Secretary. He helped to bring about this absolutely disastrous turn of events, and he was rewarded for it.
Hold on, Bloomfield's back on the thought train.
I remember what I was going to say. I'll come to that in a moment, but I just want to say about this thing about what Trump got away with. It was the scale of disqualifying statements that he made was so vast that by the end of each day, you'd forgotten about the ones he'd said at the start of the day. Just one that someone reminded me of earlier today. After the attack in Orlando, which was sort of blamed on ISIS, Donald Trump implied that Barack Obama had known about an ISIS attack and had chosen not to do anything about it. He'd known about it and just decided he didn't want to do anything about it. Remember during the second debate, I think it was, where Hillary Clinton hit him on his taxes and said maybe he doesn't pay taxes because, you know, he's been hiding things. And he says, that's because it's smart. He said you're smart for not paying taxes? If Mitt Romney had said that 4 years ago, that would be the story of the election.
Because he's a reality TV star. He's not being judged as a politician because he's never been one.
The thing I was going to say before when I completely lost my train of thought was about progress. And I think what we have been reminded of today, this week, not that we should have needed reminding, but we really did, was that you have to fight for it. And even things that you think you've won, you have to fight for. So yes, Andrew, as you say, the idea that a presidential candidate, a president, can boast about sexually assaulting women and then also have a dozen different women coming forward to say, yes, actually, he did that to me, and yet still be elected, just goes to show you have to keep fighting for this. You have to fight for the rights that you think you've won, because there are always going to be, every revolution has a counter-revolution. You always have to fight back.
And, you know, the amazing thing, the street demonstrations are not really an end. They're the hint of more to come. But the good thing is that lots of Americans feel that fire, that sense that, you know, when an election goes against you, you know, you realize that the person in power does not represent your beliefs and your take on the world. And for the first few days, you feel, you know, disenchanted and you feel outside the system. But that anger, and that is important, that anger can turn you into, you know, somebody who can spearhead change and be an amazing civil rights leader. We should just look at what this means around the world too, because figures in global politics, you know, they all offered their congratulations after the vote, some in more muted tones than other. Angela Merkel extended goodwill, but with some fairly clear stipulations. Boris Johnson, however, claimed the world should snap out of its collective whingeathon. Tom, how do you rate the reception for Mr. Trump internationally?
Well, it struck me as interesting. I mean, a number of leaders came out and made the bland pronouncements one would expect, where they say we look forward to working together, and, you know, we must keep dialogue going, and that's where, you know, progress will come from. And they were met with no little measure of derision, because people said, look, well, you know, you voiced your concerns about him before, you should restate them once he's in the top job. I'm not saying that, you know, realpolitik trumps everything, for want of a better phrase, but I understand that world leaders, there's no real point in throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think you need to strike a conciliatory tone, make sure you can have dialogue, and then see what this man is about. There's no point in ostracizing him or rather ostracizing yourself, you know, sending yourself to Coventry so that you're not in a position to maybe bend his ear or speak to him or get a dialogue going. I really think in terms of the broader impact on the prosecution of international affairs and diplomacy, it's impossible to tell. It's compelling because, again, he seems to have isolated himself from so many different countries, so many different people. But come January, who knows? I mean, I think that gives him, and I rather like this about the US political cycle, that there is this little window between the success at the ballot box and then the actual inauguration. It gives him time to maybe think for 5 minutes, which is obviously not something that he spent a lot of time doing before.
We'll see about that.
Some people have been suggesting that, you know, he's, you know, his take on Russia, while it seems a little bit queasy to many of us, actually does offer the opportunity for a little bit of a rapprochement. You know, he won't be feeling the need to tweak the tail or, you know, to hem in Mr. Putin, and might like a kind of man hug or a bit of a bear fight with the guy. That he might actually, in that sense, his take on diplomacy when things are so tense, he may actually be quite good there.
Well, I'm sure our Estonian, Latvian and Lithuanian friends will be very happy about that. This is a guy who during the election said he had no problem with Russia annexing Crimea from Ukraine, had no problem either with what was happening in eastern Ukraine. And one suspects that he's going to have, you know, whatever limited support there was from the US for rebels in Syria, one suspects that is coming to an end too. To go back to what we were saying about world leaders, and I think, you know, there is a tone that needs to be struck. And I think Angela Merkel and the German Foreign Minister Steinmeier struck that very well by reminding America of the values that it holds dear. It was interesting, Paul Keating is the former Australian Prime Minister, and it's always easier, obviously, when you're out of office, but was very good last night on ABC, saying, essentially, I don't understand why we subordinate ourselves towards the United States. Our society is a better society, the United States. We have universal health protection from cradle to grave. We have retirement income system with superannuation. We have high participation rates in schools. We don't shoot our children in schools. If they were to be shot, we'd take the guns off the people who shot them. This is a better society than the United States. I think he's got a point, and there's nothing wrong with other liberal nations, those that can still call themselves liberal nations, saying, you know what, if that's the way you're going, fine, but we're not going to see you as the shining city on the hill anymore.
Yeah, and I think in UK politics, you know, Theresa May is in a desperate position. She's going to have to...
She needs friends everywhere.
Yeah, she will do what... You know, whatever it takes to get Mr. Trump on board. And, you know, many Tories believe that, you know, Obama was not a friend to this nation. Rubbish. But, you know, they will do everything to pander to Mr. Trump. But it's again, when you come back to this, his role on the international stage, do you think there's any good that he can do?
Honestly, no. And I think the thing that worries me is... Now, this on the surface seems minor, but there is the threat of a civil war in Democratic Republic of Congo. I understand completely why this was never going to be mentioned in any US election campaign.
I don't know if you could even point it on a map.
Quite. But what's interesting about what's happening in Congo is the role of America as the guarantor of any peace agreement, the role of America in ensuring that that 18,000 strong UN peacekeeping force stays there and is doing its job properly, the role of America in making sure that Joseph Kabila, the current president, who is supposed to step down, is put under some pressure. Now, under the Trump presidency, I mean, will they even fill the position of ambassador to Kinshasa? Will they be backing UN peacekeeping missions in Congo? What are they going to be doing? Now, obviously, that is not issue number one when it comes to foreign policy for America. But there's this whole apparatus around the world where America plays this crucial role, and it's about to absent itself. And we can maybe look to Germany, we can maybe look to the European Union and think, well, at some stage, they might try and play that role. But that's not going to happen immediately. And there's going to be this vacuum. And it's incredibly dangerous.
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, very cheerful Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards coming up next. How will Donald Trump fare taking up the presidency with no experience in politics?
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive. and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brûlé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, and Steve Bloomfield. I'm going to get to Tom first because I think he's going to put a jolly face on it. Do you need any experience to do a job? You can speak from experience.
Andrew, this feels strangely like a leading question. Let's brush on from that. No, listen, I think there's no question that the specific demands of, you know, international diplomacy, the nuances of politics, are such that any experience will be valuable. I'll put it that way. Do you need experience? Well, clearly he hasn't got any. So in that sense, you don't. It's no hindrance to getting the job. Will it preclude him from doing a good job? I think possibly. And this is something that we'll only discover as he gets stuck in. You know, we know that he styled himself as the, you know, the great deal maker. But then we look at his business career and actually the great deals look rather hard to find. So I think the important thing to question here is, what's Trump's motivation going to be? He's going to be all about serving ego. He needs to feel like he's getting people's approval. He needs to feel like he knows what he's doing. So I think, actually, rather than run headlong into all sorts of confrontations, he'll probably, I imagine he's probably going to play safe. I think it's easier for him to look good by his reckoning, in a sense, the less hard work of politics that he has to do. That's kind of what I'm hoping for, that he enjoys the bluster, he flies around in Air Force One, he visits golf courses, he does lots of shaky hands, and then he leaves the nitty-gritty for faceless, you know, grey careerist Republicans who kind of know the workings of Capitol Hill a bit better.
Steve?
Let's talk about a faceless, grey careerist. Mike Pence. So, when Donald Trump was first looking for his vice presidential candidate, he first of all approached John Kasich, who's one of the candidates in the presidential race, the governor of Ohio, a moderate in the modern Republican sense. And he apparently said to him, look, I want you to be the chief executive. I'll be the chairman. So you will basically be in charge of most things. Kasich said no. One suspects he offered the same deal to Mike Pence, who I think is now probably going to become a more powerful vice president than even Dick Cheney was. And with Mike Pence, along with Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House, you're going to see a traditional hard right Republican government. When we talk about who else he's going to surround himself with, you know, when they talk about, well, Rudy Giuliani might be coming back in, or Newt Gingrich, or even, of course, there's all the old neoconservatives from the 2000s under George W. Bush, when we talk about foreign policy, you know, the Richard Perls and the Paul Wolfowitzes and so on, you know, the idea of them coming back to be somehow a good thing because they have experience, well,
but Trump,
we've experienced their experience.
I can't see Trump bringing in these really big personalities. That, you know, I think he's, I'm not saying he is able to or will seek to surround himself with yes men, but I don't see him bringing in people who will, for want of a better phrase, rub up against him the wrong way. I think it'll be a much blander White House than
actually,
that.
That's a good point. The fact of, you know, as a businessman, you know, he runs his company, and it's the way he runs his company is very much on sort of a yes men style. There is no one within Trump Inc. who says, you know what, Donald, I think that's a bad idea. And that's going to be tricky in a presidency.
Well, not very cheerful times. Leave us with a good note, Tom. What do you do when you know, if you're an American person who didn't vote for Trump and you want to kind of fight back? You've got just a few seconds to give us a top tip.
Well, the flippant remark would be, you know, move north of the border to Trudeau's Elysian fields of Canada. I think it's what you said earlier, Andrew, which is to remind yourself the values that you care about and be proactive. So whether that is moving, whether it's seizing the nettle, whether it's becoming a political activist, whether it's just restating your principles, it's never a bad time to remind yourself what's really important.
Don't move to Canada, move to Pennsylvania.
And just tip the vote slightly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you have it.
Organise.
The lobbyists have met. But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also Judith Serra and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. More music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. Midori House, well, it's going to be back at the very same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.